Welcome back, learner. So, we all know that sudden sinking feeling when you sign what you just assume is a standard run-of-the-mill contract.
Oh, right, like a gym membership or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or like a new software subscription.
Yeah.
And then, you know, years later, you actually sit down and read the fine print.
Which nobody ever does.
Right, nobody does it. But when you do, you are just hit with this realization that the agreement you've been operating under is... I mean, it's entirely different from the one you thought you signed.
The terms are wildly different.
Yeah. The obligations are much heavier and the penalties are, well, they're devastatingly real.
It completely shatters your operating paradigm. You just wake up to the fact that you haven't been playing by the actual rules of the arrangement this whole time.
Oh, completely.
And usually the consequences of that ignorance are already in motion by the time you realize it.
And honestly, that feeling of just absolute disorientation... that is the foundation of what we are exploring today.
It really is.
For this deep dive, we are examining a narrative that, frankly, many people think they already know inside and out. It's the parable of the rich fool from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12.
Which is a classic.
Right. And if you grew up in a church environment, or even if you're just, you know, familiar with Western literature, this story usually gets pitched as this cozy, simple, moral fable.
Yeah, they really soften it.
They do. The lesson gets watered down to something like, don't be greedy, or, I don't know, make sure you have a good work-life balance.
Which, I mean, that completely sanitizes the text.
Yeah.
Because the historical and linguistic context reveals the scandalous, earth-shattering critique of how the universe actually operates.
It's intense.
To a first century Judean audience, this was definitely not a gentle warning about taking time off. It was, frankly, a terrifying exposure of spiritual treason.
Wow. Spiritual treason. Well, we've got our hands on a deeply fascinating exegesis today that really digs into the cultural context of this parable.
It's fantastic source material.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to look at this text from a Christian perspective, unpack the hidden Greek nuances that just evaporate in modern English translations, and figure out how this radical critique of economics and isolation challenges our daily struggles with obedience to God today.
Because there's a lot of friction there for us today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because if you walk away thinking this is just a story about a guy who built a few too many barns, I mean, you haven't read the fine print. So, okay, let's unpack this.
To fully grasp that fine print and to understand how fundamentally this man misunderstood his relationship with God, we actually need to start at the very end of his life.
Right. Skipping to the end.
Yeah, because the final decree from God completely recontextualizes every single action the man took up to that point.
So the story builds up to this pinnacle moment where the rich man has hoarded all this immense wealth. He's feeling incredibly secure. And then suddenly God speaks.
Right.
And in our English translations, it reads something like, "This night your soul is required of you," which, you know, it sounds solemn.
Poetic almost.
Yeah, poetic. Almost like this gentle, albeit sudden, slipping away into the afterlife.
Well, the original Greek text carries a completely different tone. It is not gentle.
Not at all.
Not at all. The word used for required is apituzen. And it is not a poetic word by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay, so what does it actually mean?
It is a strict, cold, financial, and legal term.
Wait, really?
Yeah. A literal translation would be, they are demanding back.
Demanding back. So it's, I mean, it's a transactional term.
It's the exact terminology used in ancient banking when a creditor suddenly calls in a loan.
Oh, wow.
The rich man has lived his entire life under this staunch delusion that he owned his life, his land, his, you know, phenomenal harvest.
Right. He thought he was the boss.
But the text drops this terrifying reality on him. His life was never his property. It was merely leased to him by the creator.
It's on loan.
Exactly. And now in the dead of night, the divine creditor is foreclosing on the property. The debt is being called in.
Man, just think about the implications of that for a second. It's like, okay, it's like renting a house, right? And after a few years, you just decide to knock down all the interior walls,
right,
rip up the original flooring, and build this massive extension in the backyard.
Right, just totally renovating the place.
Yeah, and you never once consult the landlord because you've somehow convinced yourself you hold the deed.
You're living a total delusion.
Exactly. And then one evening, there's a knock at the door, and it's the actual owner with the sheriff and an eviction notice demanding the keys. I mean, the shock of realizing your entire living situation was built on an illusion of ownership.
It's terrifying. And the suddenness of the divine demand shatters that illusion instantly. But, you know, the specific property being repossessed makes it even more visceral.
Right, because of the word soul.
Yes. When English readers see that God is demanding back his soul, the Greek word is psyche, we tend to view that through like a Greek philosophical lens.
Sure, we picture this disembodied spiritual ghost floating away from the body.
Right, the invisible ethereal part of a person.
Yeah, exactly.
But the biblical context here is heavily influenced by the Hebrew concept of nephesh. And in that tradition, psyche doesn't mean a ghost.
Okay.
It encompasses your life, your breath, your physical appetites, your whole integrated self.
Everything that makes you alive.
Exactly. So earlier in the narrative, when the man says to himself, you know, soul, you have ample goods, relax, eat, drink, be merry, he is directly addressing his physical appetites. He's feeding his nephesh.
Oh, I see.
So when God demands his psyche back, using that cold banking term, God is demanding back his literal breath.
God is repossessing the man's lungs.
Literally.
Repossessing the very mechanism required to enjoy all those hoarded crops.
It's the ultimate foreclosure, and this cuts to the core of what Christian obedience actually entails.
Yeah, that changes the starting point.
Yes. The absolute foundation of obedience is the recognition of this divine lease. It requires acknowledging that our breath, our intellect, our skills, and our resources, they are not ours. They're strictly on lease.
So if a person starts from the premise of ownership, every subsequent action they take will be fundamentally disobedient.
Because the entire foundation of their reality is a lie.
Right. But I mean, if the entire foundation is a lie and God holds the ultimate lease on our lives, how does a farmer in a deeply religious, ancient agrarian society just miss this?
That's a great question.
Like, he is surrounded by religious ritual and community.
Yeah.
It takes a supreme level of arrogance to just write God out of the equation.
It does. But the text gives us a specific diagnosis for his condition. God calls the man a fool, which in the Greek is aphron.
Aphron, okay.
And modern English has really diluted this word. If we call someone a fool today, we usually imply a lack of intelligence or, you know, that they are gullible enough to fall for a scam.
Yeah, we treat it like an IQ deficiency, like they're just not smart.
Right. But in the biblical wisdom tradition, an aphron is not someone lacking intellect or business acumen.
I mean, he was obviously good at farming.
Exactly. This man was clearly a successful, calculated agricultural businessman. Rather, an aphron is someone who is morally deficient and practically blind to ultimate reality.
Blind to reality.
Yeah. Consider Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool says in his heart, there is no God.
Oh, wow. So that shifts it entirely from an intellectual failing to a profound spiritual blindness.
Precisely. The rich man is a fool because he operates as what we would call a practical atheist.
Practical atheist.
Yeah, he might theoretically acknowledge a deity. He might observe the required festivals at the synagogue. But in the boardroom of his own mind, in his day-to-day business practices, he lives as though God does not exist.
Like God has absolutely no claim on him.
Exactly.
And I guess the ultimate symptom of this practical atheism is how he talks to himself about his future. I mean, he tells his soul, his appetites, to relax or take thine ease. And our sources highlight that the Greek word used there, anapoō, is intrinsically tied to the concept of Sabbath rest.
Yeah, that word choice is not an accident. He isn't merely planning a long vacation.
Right.
He genuinely believes that through his own massive material accumulation, he has secured ultimate peace. He is attempting to manufacture his own Sabbath.
Okay, I have to pause here and push back on this a little bit on behalf of anyone listening, because this hits incredibly close to home for our modern culture.
Oh, absolutely.
We have entire financial ecosystems built on creating your own peace. So is saving for retirement inherently bad? I mean, from a modern perspective, this guy is just being financially prudent.
Sure.
He worked hard, the weather cooperated, he had a massive crop, and he's telling himself he can finally rest. Financial planners would literally put this guy on a brochure.
They really would. And the tension you are highlighting is exactly why this parable is so disruptive today.
Okay.
The distinction the text makes is between prudent stewardship and outright usurpation. The sin highlighted in this exegesis is not the act of saving grain for a lean season.
Right. It's not just about having a savings account.
No. The sin is the attempt to replace the creator with the creation.
Oh. He's trying to purchase the security that only God can offer.
Exactly. When he looks at his overflowing barns and says, "Now I can finally rest," he reveals where his ultimate trust lies. He has replaced God with his crops.
Wow.
True obedience involves trusting God for our ultimate Sabbath rest and recognizing that our security comes from the divine leaseholder, rather than obsessively trying to hoard enough material wealth to make ourselves invincible.
Because you can't be invincible.
Right. And you know, what's fascinating here is that his internal spiritual failure, this practical atheism where he crowns himself as his own God, it cannot possibly stay contained in his own head.
Yeah, it has to spill over into how he treats the people around him in his village.
It inevitably does. Mm. And the sources point to an ancient Mediterranean concept known as the image of limited good, which...
Yeah, that blew my mind a little
bit. It's such a foreign concept to us.
From what I gather, they didn't view the economy as something that could expand or grow, mm-hmm. which completely changes how they would have viewed this man's massive surplus, right?
Exactly. The image of limited good is crucial for understanding the sheer hostility the original audience would have felt toward this man. In a modern capitalist framework, we just assume wealth can be generated.
Right. A new technological innovation creates new jobs, new markets, and the overall economic pie gets larger.
The rising tide lifts all boats philosophy.
Exactly.
But first century agrarian societies operated on the exact opposite assumption. They believed that everything, land, grain, wealth, even honor, existed in finite static quantities.
So it was a strict zero-sum game.
Completely. The pie was baked, and it was never getting any bigger.
Meaning, if your slice of the pie suddenly gets massively larger, the immediate assumption is that someone else's slice just got smaller?
Consequently, if one person in a village became extraordinarily wealthy and hoarded a massive surplus, the community didn't applaud their business savvy.
They weren't asking him for a TED Talk.
No, they assumed the wealth was extracted at the direct expense of the vulnerable. So when this rich man experiences a bumper crop, he doesn't take it to the market. He doesn't lower prices. Instead, he tears down his existing barns, the apothecas, which were already large storehouses, and builds even more massive ones solely to stockpile his grain.
Man, this just reminds me of the panic buying we see during modern crises.
Yeah.
You know, people going out and buying up pallets of hand sanitizer or essential supplies.
Oh, that's a perfect parallel.
Right. Because they don't need 50 bottles of sanitizer for their own family. They are hoarding it to create a bottleneck, either out of sheer paranoia or to, like, scalp it online later.
Yeah, they're exploiting the shortage.
And the visceral anger we feel toward those people today because they are profiting off the deprivation of their neighbors, I mean, that is the exact mechanism happening in this parable.
The mechanics of that panic buy mirror the first century agricultural market perfectly. By withholding that immense amount of grain from the local economy during a bumper crop, he is artificially restricting the supply.
He's choking the market.
Yes. He is actively creating artificial scarcity. And this immediately drives up the price of grain for the poor peasants in his vicinity. To the crowd listening to Jesus, this man was not a shrewd investor.
Right.
He was an economic predator starving his neighbors to pad his own security.
Which really reframes obedience entirely. Because obedience to God isn't just about what you do in a synagogue on the weekend. It dictates your economic footprint.
Absolutely.
Managing a surplus isn't this private, isolated matter. It directly impacts the survival of the community. Exploiting the market for personal peace is framed here as direct disobedience to the true owner of the resources.
And, you know, to commit that level of economic predation, to look out at your village struggling with inflated grain prices while you construct massive new silos, it requires a chilling level of detachment.
Oh, yeah. And here's where it gets really interesting in the sources. The Greek text actually hides this massive literary clue about just how detached this man really is.
Yes, the pronouns.
Yeah, it's a grammatical detail that is just so oppressive once you finally notice it. It's what they call the crisis of pronouns.
Mm.
I actually want to read just three verses from the text, and I want you to listen to the suffocating use of the words I and my, which in Greek is mu.
It's very striking.
Right. So he says, "What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul," I mean, it's almost claustrophobic. He uses first-person pronouns over a dozen times in just a few sentences.
The isolation is palpable. And notice who is missing from that internal monologue.
Yeah.
He consults absolutely no one.
He doesn't ask his spouse for advice. Mm-hmm. He doesn't consult a business partner or the village elders.
Nothing.
He certainly doesn't pray and ask God what to do with the surplus. He just has this echoing conversation with his own appetites.
And in the context of the first century Mediterranean world, that level of isolation is pathological.
Pathological.
Yes. This was a highly communal, honor and shame based culture. An individual's identity was completely interwoven with their kinship group and their village.
You didn't exist apart from them.
Right. So if a landowner owner was blessed with a massive, unprecedented surplus, the socially expected behavior, the honorable path, was to utilize that wealth to build social capital.
Okay, so you would throw a massive feast, become a patron to lower class clients, maybe forgive debts, and basically create a social safety net. You distribute the wealth to cement your place in the community.
Precisely. But the man in the parable does none of that. There are no friends mentioned, no family ties, no community obligations. He is radically, terrifyingly alone.
Wow.
His practical atheism, his complete rejection of God's authority, has naturally metastasized into total social isolation.
It's like disobedience builds a prison of one. If you make yourself the absolute center of your universe, you eventually push everyone else out of orbit.
That's a great way to put it.
Because true Christian obedience demands community. It requires viewing our blessings and resources as communal assets designed by God to bless others rather than, you know, bricks to build our own isolated fortresses.
And his private fortress of I and my sets up the devastating, ironic punchline of the entire narrative.
Right. The end.
When God finally speaks, repossessing the man's breath and calling in the lease, he asks one piercing question. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be?
Man, that's heavy. Because he alienated every single person in his relentless pursuit of self-preservation, he literally has no one to leave his empire to.
No one.
He spent his entire life manipulating markets and building massive structures to secure a future he will never even experience, only to have all of those accumulated goods instantly scattered to absolute strangers the millisecond his heart stops.
And the historical context of why Jesus told this parable makes the irony even sharper.
Remind me how it starts again.
The narrative begins because Jesus is teaching a crowd, and a man suddenly interrupts him, shouting, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me."
Oh, right. The guy is literally airing his bitter family financial disputes right in the middle of a public teaching.
Exactly. Jesus uses the parable of the rich fool to expose the sheer absurdity of that interruption.
Right.
You are destroying your family relationships over wealth that you cannot ultimately keep. You are fighting tooth and nail over leased property that is going to be repossessed anyway.
It's so pointless.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Jesus concludes the teaching by contrasting this foolishness with the call to be rich toward God.
Which brings up a great question. How would a first century Jewish audience have understood that phrase? Because, you know, in modern vernacular, being rich toward God sounds incredibly abstract.
It does.
It sounds like having a robust prayer life or cultivating a feeling of deep spiritual peace or something.
Yeah, but it was not an abstract emotional concept in first century Jewish theology. Being rich toward God was a concrete, highly visible action.
Oh, really?
Yes. It specifically referred to the practice of almsgiving, distributing your wealth to the poor and vulnerable.
The rich man's ultimate folly was failing to understand the mechanics of the eternal economy. The text posits that the only way to genuinely keep your wealth, the only method to transfer it ahead of you into eternity, is to actually give it away to those in need in the present moment.
So, what does this all mean for us today? I guess the ultimate act of obedience is relinquishing control. It's this profound realization that you cannot hoard your way into absolute security.
No, you really can't.
True obedience is managing the temporary lease God has granted you in a way that actively blesses the community and ultimately honors the actual owner of the assets.
Absolutely.
We've covered so much ground today, and it really completely shifts the perspective on a story we thought we knew. I mean, it elevates a simple moral tale about greed into this profound wake-up call regarding divine ownership, the danger of manufacturing our own Sabbath, and the economic responsibilities we have to our neighbors. The text forces a deeply uncomfortable self-audit.
Oh, for sure.
It demands that you look at the structure of your own life and ask, who genuinely holds the lease right now? Are you operating as the owner, or are you faithfully managing the property as a tenant?
I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over today, Lorner. Throughout this entire deep dive, our focus has been primarily on material wealth. Physical, tangible things.
Yeah.
Grain, massive agricultural yields, wooden barns.
The physical stuff.
Right. But consider this. What if the barns you and I are obsessively building today aren't physical structures?
Yeah.
What if we are hoarding our time? What if we are fiercely hoarding our professional reputations, our emotional energy, or our desperate need to control the trajectory of our own lives? If the divine creditor calls in the loan on your time tonight, Will you be found hoarding it in a private, isolated kingdom of I and my, just to ensure your own comfort? Or will you be found giving it away, pouring it into your community, and actively being rich toward God? Because when the fine print is finally read, you have to answer the question, whose name is really on the contract of your life? Until next time, keep diving deep.